Oh, hi, and welcome to another episode of the Westmarks Workshop. It's been a little bit. I know that this episode is coming a week delayed, and I am sorry for that. But, you know, there's just been some rough stuff going on with the personal life. I know that I complain about work quite a bit, but unfortunately, these past couple of weeks, I have been dealing with the passing of my mother. So, things still aren't, like, you know, fully quite back to normal, and I understand that it's going to take some time for that to happen. But yeah, you know, I'm doing well. You know, every day is a little bit better than the last, and you know, let's just go ahead, not dwell on the negatives. This episode is mostly all about positives. Mainly being, of course, we have the lovely Diablo 2 Resurrected Alpha that came out of nowhere and has been taking the Diablo community by storm. Though that did bring out some less than nice behaviors out of some. I've got some strong feelings about this remake frenzy that's been going on, maybe not necessarily with it applying to video games, but with in aspects of movies. And then also we got some, maybe an update on Diablo Immortal? I'm not sure. We'll have to wait and figure that one out. And of course, we'll be closing out the episode, as we have been with the last few, with some lore talk, with an interesting question that came up during my Diablo 2 streams about what exactly happened and was the history of all of the heroes of the Diablo franchise. And you know, with that, let's go ahead, start the show. It's like, sometimes I try to leave like the big topics, you know, towards the end or the middle or something along those lines, but Diablo 2 deserves top billing, and it is at the front of the queue. You know, I obviously, since they announced it at BlizzCon earlier this year, you know, it's awesome. I've talked about it for years, you know, with Dread and Leviathan and such, about it would be cool, you know, it'll be awesome. I would enjoy going back and playing a Diablo 2 with updated graphics, and it's something that is going to go and suck away a lot of my time. But damn, I was not expecting the experience that I got from the alpha this past weekend, and that is why I am titling this episode 207 I'm a Believer, because I was already excited for the game, but you know, I had come from the angle of I have played over a decade of Diablo 2. You know, it's probably still like my most played game of like all time. You know, back before you have bills and responsibilities and other crap like that, you just sit and chill and veg on a game for 12 hours at a time, you know, without any type of detriment whatsoever. You know, the job doesn't start calling you, the girlfriend doesn't get mad, and your hand doesn't start hurting from a 12-hour gaming session. You know, back in your teens, you know, or your early 20s and such. But wow, it just like it's so strange, because it is the same game but better. Like it's so hard to put into words, because it is literally the same exact game. If you remember how to do stuff in Diablo 2, it is literally exactly the same, except everything is just better. Like, you know, because of the graphics update with the graphical engine that lays over top of it, it is so smooth. Like, you feel as if the game responds or reacts quicker, though it doesn't. Because you can tab back and forth between that remaster view and the classic view. And I was doing it a lot on the stream, because there was so many times that like, you'd walk up to an area and it's like, none of this shit existed. And you just press the G key. You know, you press that G key and then it goes back to the classic view. There's so many times like running through like the jail or the catacombs, the sewers, and it's like, you know, there was one part where I was blown away by a rug on the floor. Like, it doesn't sound like a lot, but you're walking through the catacombs of the Rogues Monastery, where the Rogues don't live in the Rogue encampment. The Rogues lived in the monastery until Andariel got summoned, corrupted everybody, and forced those few survivors out of the monastery. You know, that's where all of the Rogues lived, you know, their everyday lives. And when you're going and walking through all of that, it's all just in the classic game, it's all just stone walls and, you know, stone floors, and that's it. Because everything is the same. You know, occasionally there'll be like a bookshelf that has like a scroll in it, you know, or like a little desk or something like that, but that's it. But going and playing through the alpha, every once in a while, you come across a tile that, instead of a stone floor, it's a wooden floor. There's a rug there and like some, like, you know, like a dresser instead of just a desk. And it's like, someone lived here. Like, this is like someone's like bedroom or like a common area. Like, this one room ties together the aesthetic and everything else of that. This was actually a place that people like lived, you know, to help just pull in that immersion. And so for those that were there watching me on stream, like, my jaw was on the floor as I tapped back and forth. Like, this is just in the original, this is just a room. In the remaster, this is a living space. Like, it's just the attention to detail that the developers had to go through to add in tiny little things like this that work. You know, obviously there maybe there was some concept art and stuff like that they got some of these ideas from in order to go and do it. But in the classic game, there are none of these doodads. Like, you go through the sewer, you know, and there's like corpses and ladders and all this other types of stuff, like dugouts in the walls and such, when you go back into the original, and it's just walls. You know, there's no like drains and things with the sewer water flowing through and such. It's like they really made these places not just have like a graphical glow up. They went to the next level and made these places feel, for lack of a better word, real. Like, it's like one of those ones. It was like just amazing. It was awesome to see all those little things, and it's those little details that really turned me like into a believer in this game. Like, I was already like full blown knew I was gonna love this game because I love Diablo 2, and so it's like, oh, Diablo 2 of updated graphics, oh yeah, sure, I'm all on board. But the updated graphics added so much more that I was not expecting. Like, I was not expecting this level of detail. That they're treating it more than just a remaster. They're like giving this like the full treatment as if it is a modern ARPG being released today. Like, just the amount of love and detail and attention that they're putting into this title rivals anything else. That would just be, if this game came out right now, like, you would just expect that this is just a brand new game that someone made, not a remaster of a 21-year-old title. You know, until you hit the G key and then you see the 21-year-old title behind it. And it's something else. And then there's so many other little quality of life changes that, like, I didn't even know. And like, people in chat are like, oh, just hit that button, hold down that key, you know, just check there. And it's like, so like, it has like the expanded character stats, so you don't have to manually tally all of the magic find on your character. You just, you know, open the advanced stats on the LCS, and then it will tell you what your magic find is. Like, amazing. Gambling. Gambling. Everybody that's played D2 knows it's like you have to close the window, then reopen the gamble, and so that way you see what's there. And so it's just constantly closing and reopening, closing and reopen, you know, because I want to spend some money on some gamba, and it was like a process. Now it's just got a button. There's a refresh button down at the bottom. Like, I was doing it for like 5 minutes straight of just trying to go through and gamble for some stuff on my barbarian, and then someone in chat was just like, why don't you just hit the button? What do you mean just hit the button? What button? Oh my god. And then it's just, it's not just in the remaster. You go back to the classic game, that refresh button is now there. So even playing in the classic style, if you don't want the graphics, and you want to be that true-to-form purist, it has that quality of life. Now, I believe that there's probably some sections in there that you can choose to turn off those quality of life changes, but it's big. And then, like, you know, this was a single-player alpha, so you didn't have anybody to help you mule items or anything over to alts, but it had a shared stash. Now, it wasn't available in the alpha itself. You couldn't share money, but it had a little like asterisk there that said not yet implemented. It will eventually allow you to share gold, but that was the only thing that you couldn't transfer over. But you can always just transfer over shit that sells for a lot, you know, in order to kind of pseudo, you know, carry gold over to a different character. And that shared stash, again, was huge. Being able to, you know, go through and just take a couple extra items over with you when you remade an alt, without having to go through and try and, you know, perm a game or ask a character or ask a friend to sit in a game for you while you try to mule items over and such. It's, I know, you know, people might play like Pluggy and other stuff like that had those bonuses or innovations to the engine, you know, in the past, but I've only ever just played, like, you know, the Diablo 2 without mods or anything like that, so that was a game changer for me, at least. But yeah, you know, and like going through and looking at it, the detail, I know the character models have gotten a lot of flack, you know, because, you know, they're kind of old or more rugged looking than people were expecting. I can't tell you how many people were upset that, like, the rogue wasn't wearing makeup or lipstick or something. And we've seen dozens of people, oh, here's my take on XYZ. It's just like, okay, dude, whatevs, you know. But it's the going back and, like, on the character screen and, like, fully seeing the armor or having that zoom feature where you can zoom in a little bit more on your character, the character models are more impressive than what they are in Diablo 3. I mean, like, the graphics themselves, like, really rival Diablo 3. Now, obviously, they're going for more realistic, whereas Diablo 3 went for the more stylistic. And I've done episodes in the past, and I'm not really going to go through and rehash a lot of those arguments and comparisons and contrasts. But I don't think anyone can really argue that, at least, like, the character models, the armor on the sprites and such that we've seen in the D2R definitely look like they're going to be closer to what we're getting in Diablo 4 than what we had in Diablo 3. Like, this isn't a cheap remaster. This is them really going through and taking their time to model these armor pieces and these textures and such. And, you know, they look good. Now, I can't wait to start seeing some of the like, high-end sets and such. What some of these uniques and things are going to look like on the characters. Because we could only play to Act 2. You know, so the ceiling for the item levels that we could get from Magic Pine and such was pretty limited. But, you know, here's hoping. Here's a real big hoping that we get it sooner rather than later to go and check some of these things out. It's really, really cool, and it gives me a lot of hope, just, you know, with, well, shoot, they're doing this good of a job on the D2 character models. What is it going to be like when they show, like, really show off, like, some of these finalized models for Diablo 4, you know, when we start seeing, we've only seen, like, the base character models and, like, some basic gear. Even though they showed us, like, uniques and things, they haven't shown us what those uniques look like on the character. And it's, yeah, I'm excited. Everything that I saw in D2 Resurrected really carried over some of my excitement for Diablo 4. And man, I'm gonna say this in like every single podcast from now until, I don't know, years from now. It's a great time to be a Diablo player. It's a great time to be an ARPG player, to be a fan of the genre and such, because we're gonna have so many choices from now until forever. Because in addition to, you know, having like a huge, even though, you know, personal things have kept me from really playing Diablo 3 for season 23, like, this has been one of the most popular seasons that there has been in a long time. The just like the simple update to the followers and making solo play easier and more accessible has gotten people coming out of the woodwork to come back into Diablo 3. We just had the Diablo 2 technical alpha back in December. We had the Diablo Immortal technical alpha, and we've got like the quarterly updates coming at us regularly for Diablo 4. It's like we've got so much to go through as a Diablo fan right now, and you know, it's not gonna stop anytime soon. You know, we know that there's gonna be more testing for D2R Resurrected. The game played phenomenal. Like, there were some loading bugs, there were some game crashes and compatibility issues. Like, I've seen some people that, like, they couldn't get the game to run, like, with OBS. Some people said that, like, Steam was preventing their game to run. There were a lot of issues with compatibility, but that's what the alpha is for. You know, it wasn't optimized or anything like that. It was just, you know, running raw. Like, and it maxed like your GPU usage for a lot of machines as well, because it just wasn't, none of the textures were optimized for performance or anything like that. You know, and so it's definitely got some work ahead of it, more on the technical side, but the gameplay looked good. You know, it's not quite as, say, smooth as what Diablo 3 is. Some of the character animations, you know, are a little bit janky, but that's also because you're coming from, it's a 3D overlay of a 2D game, and so it's just going to have some jank to it. You know, if you're running and turn a sharp angle, like, your character just like leans into that turn at an obscene amount. You know, I'm sure that they can fix it up a little bit, but at the end of the day, like, you're just, your character just turns around like 360, like in a frame or two. It's just what it is, you know, because the game works on frames instead of timing. It's, you know, it's gonna be really hard to, like, to flawlessly implement that, but it still looks really good, can't wait for the next round. You know, I was honored and privileged to be, you know, one of those ones that was, you know, selected by Blizzard and given a key in order to go through and test it out. That's why I was more than happy to go and stream, you know, just to kind of show a little bit of my appreciation for being one of those, you know, selected people. And, you know, next one that comes around, I'm definitely going to be going through and streaming there. I would like to stream some more Diablo 3 in the future as things continue to go and settle down and what have you. But when it comes to testing, I have to wonder what's going to come next. You know, are we going to get, you know, more acts, more classes? You know, it's not like they're hiding the story or anything. We all know what the story is. But maybe they're hiding some, like, skill and level progression or something like that. But they're still working on some things. And then also, one of the other big things for this test was controller support. A lot of people had really good things to say about controller support. And, you know, maybe I'll go out and get a PC controller just to go and play, because it seemed to impress, like, a lot of people and be easier on the hands for those all-day gaming sessions and such. But who knows? As I mentioned before, you know, both the topic of D2 Resurrected and some other things that have been going on has gotten me thinking a lot about remakes. And there are some things like Diablo 2. They're remaking the game, or I guess I should say it's not a remake, it's a remaster, you know, because it's literally the same game, but a few quality of life tweaks in some updated graphics as an overlay to the original engine. But, like, anyone that knows me knows I'm a big movie person. I talk a lot about it, you know, in the after shows and such. If you come hang out and join the show live on Twitch, I'm a huge movie buff. And, you know, the Snyder Cut is this thing. And a lot of people have enjoyed it. A lot of people have liked it. It's caught a lot of discussion and such. People that hated the original Justice League have now, you know, kind of like gotten on board with it, with the Snyder Cut and such. But the thing that annoys me about it is that, like, people are treating it as if this is what the movie should have been in the first place. And, like, maybe that is what the movie should have been in the first place, but that if, you know, the things that happened in Zack Snyder's life didn't happen and didn't force him to go through and come out of the production of that movie, this is not what would have been put into the theaters. You would not have this 4 hours of film. You would not have, you know, $70 million of extra CGI and special effects and stuff like that put into the film. Like, Steppenwolf would have been the Steppenwolf that you saw. All the other graphics would have been what you saw. You know, that stuff that didn't matter, whether it was, you know, Whedon or Snyder at the helm of the movie. You know, like, those things, like, this, it's just been blown way out of proportion. This isn't Zack Snyder's original vision of the movie. This is a patched film with 4 years of criticism and feedback that they were able to go through and make. You know, that's what the movie is. It's you release, it's just like any other video game where you go through, you release it, you get a lot of criticism. No Man's Sky, you know, gets a lot of criticism and stuff like that, but people go through and give a lot of feedback, and then the developers go through, they patch the game, they patch the game, they patch the game. That's what the Snyder Cut is. It's not any type of true artistic vision or any type of thing like that. It's like, hey, maybe if we throw an extra, like, couple of million dollars, you know, at this film, we can go through and try and revitalize it and get some extra money out of it. Yeah, so let's patch the movie. That's all that it is. It's like a patch for a film. And then now, because it was kind of, like, successful, everybody's doing it. You know, freaking, they're talking about an Abrams cut for the Star Wars sequels. And it's like, I didn't like, you know, a couple of the Star Wars sequels I just straight up hated. But don't remake them, don't remaster them. And then it's like, it's just like, the whole thing of it, the Abrams cut. Those movies that we got were the Abrams cut. He directed and wrote two of them, and then for the middle movie, he was still one of the executive producers. Like, he had his say in those films. The movies that we got were his visions. He got the ability to check and okay and verify everything that happened in those three films. And people didn't like them. A lot of people did, a lot of people didn't. You know, that's gonna be forever the debate. You know, it doesn't matter what side you're on, you can like the film. You know, I'm not gonna come after you or anything like that. Personally, I didn't enjoy them. But I don't wanna see them remade. Like, don't try to, like, go through and recut the films to try and, you know, cater to like my side, to get the people that didn't like them to, like, re-like them, because then at that point, like, you know what, like, critics get the final say on the film, and so we have to watch the same movie like three times over like 5 years until we get, oh, that's the one that we like. You know, this isn't Blade Runner, where they just recut and re-edited the same footage and added in, like, a couple of things that might have gotten left on the editing floor to add some additional context or raise some additional questions. Like, this is, we're talking about, like, completely remaking massive swaths of the movie in order to, like, change the story. And it's just like, no, just leave it be. You know, and if you're gonna freaking, like, remake the movie, like, wait a decade or so. Like, it's just, it annoys me. Because now it's also going to create unrealistic expectations, where if a movie ever comes out and bombs, everyone's just going to be like, we want the original cut. You know, we don't like this one. Give us another. Like, is that what Hollywood's going to become now? That, like, everyone has to go out and see the bad one and generate enough interest in order to get the good one? We have to pay twice to see the film to get the movie that we should have gotten in the first place? It's like, no. No, learn from this and don't make the mistake next time. like Game of Thrones season 8. Terrible. Absolute garbage. Absolute garbage. And now they're tweeting winter is coming. They're gonna remake season 8? No, please don't. Please don't. You had your shot. You blew it. Yo, you let those people go through and do what they wanted, and like, you apparently don't know what a focus group is, or the focus group are, you know, friends of the writers, so you're not actually getting real feedback. I just leave it be. It was a mistake. Bad choices were made. Learn from it. Don't hire those people anymore, or if you do, make sure that they actually, you know, like, I don't know, do their jobs, something. I don't know. It's like one of those ones. Do something else. Just like, I don't know, do something else. Wait till, you know, you know, wait till George R.R. Martin actually like finishes writing the books, which I know that means never. But like, just wait till the books are finished before remaking it. But come on, like, just let it be dead. Let it be dead. You know, just let it die. You know, that's at least my take on those things. Sorry, I had to vent. I absolutely had to vent about that. It's been gnawing at me for weeks now, since the Snyder Cut came out, and then today was just that catalyst with all the other types of talk about oh like this is gonna be the new standard. Please no. To segue things back into, you know, discussion about Diablo, while I guess going through and keeping it on Twitter, we've got, I should have checked this beforehand, so please bear with me 1 second. I had to like do some updates for my computer and OBS and all the other type of stuff in order to go and get the D2R stream to work for me and such, and so I haven't yet to go through all of my profiles and update everything with the new updates. But the thing that I wanted to show, and taking things back to Twitter, is a little tweet from Adam Fletcher, Pez Radar, who is the community manager for the entire Diablo franchise, where he went through and he tweeted yesterday, if you're a mobile creator that is interested in Diablo, feel free to reach out and hit me up in the DMs with an intro. Would love to hear from you, and apologies if my responses are slow. Now, what does that mean? Well, it's mobile, so that means immortal. And as people have over in, you know, Echo Gaming's Discord channel, which if I'm sure that you probably know, but I've done some collaborative work with Echo over on his YouTube channel, so please go through, check him out. He's Echo Through Me on Twitter. But the man is very passionate about mobile gamings, and he swears up and down that Diablo Immortal is the future for the, like, just mobile gaming, period. He's been super excited about that. They've also been talking about it on the kind of like the unofficial Diablo Immortal Discord that is, you know, linked to the Diablo Immortal subreddit. Excuse me. And they've been doing a lot of discussion there that, you know, Adam had put out a similar tweet looking for people to contact him for mobile creators and such back in October, which ended up being just like 2 months away from when they did the technical alpha for Immortal. And now we know from BlizzCon Line that they're gonna have at least two more testing phases for Diablo Immortal, and that from the finance call, the investors call before BlizzCon Line, that they're still shooting for a 2021 release date. Does put it off for a little bit, but that would give us at least some other testing phase towards the middle of the year if those timelines match up, that we could see another testing phase for Diablo Immortal sometime in the near future. You know, definitely good possibility that we could get one this quarter, you know, based on people going through and, you know, reading between the lines, connecting T's, dotting I's, and all that. It is a stretch, and I will fully admit it is a stretch, but it gives us a little bit of hope, because Immortal is a really good game. I know some people don't want to hear that, but Immortal played phenomenally. And I cannot wait to go through and test that game and play it more. I've been spending a lot of time these past weeks, you know, on hold with the phone, or like sitting in places, waiting in places, and all those other types of stuff. I would have loved to have had Immortal at that time, because I easily could have put, you know, hours into that game every day without taking away from, you know, Diablo 3, Diablo 2, or anything like that. So I desperately want, you know, that game in my hands. And like that Diablo 2 technical alpha just came out of nowhere. We knew that they were going to be testing phases and such, but I don't think anyone really expected it that soon after BlizzCon Line, because we're only like a month and a half out from that when we went through and got slammed by it. So like, that is awesome. Like, that is cool. And you know, who knows? Maybe we'll go through and get that sometime soon. And you know, to kind of take it back on one of the negative sides, you know, because it's something that I saw with Diablo Immortal, maybe not as much, so I didn't really, you know, talk about it too much, but it's something that I saw a lot of for the D2 alpha. And like, I can understand people, you know, being really, really excited about this game. Like, Diablo 2 is so many people's like favorite game in existence. You know, if so many people, I'm sure there just isn't a game that they put more hours into than D2. It hits a special point in our lives as like millennials, of, you know, when we were going through and just like growing up and such, that we were able to dedicate time to. It was such a great game, and so it's special for a lot of people. And so people were upset that they didn't get to participate in the technical alpha. I get it. I understand. You know, you can feel like left out and such, and you feel that you have this attachment to the game, and that's the only thing that you want to do. But you know, don't turn like that disappointment of not being able to get into the alpha into like you know, negativity directed at the people that did get into the alpha. You know, the streamers, content creators. And don't let that turn into negativity towards, you know, Blizzard themselves. For the most part, the majority of people that get into the technical alpha are not streamers or content creators. Just, you only see things from the streamers and content creators because they're the ones that are out there in front of everybody's faces. But like, from the things that we saw, like, you know, Blizzard had registered the Diablo 2 technical alpha with like, you know, a Korean, you know, like gaming agency. And they had, in those documents that they submitted in order to go through and have that testing phase over in Korea, it was listed for like 20,000 people. And now we don't know if that's 20,000 people in the entirety of the alpha, or 20,000 people that were just like in the Korean side of the alpha or something like that. But like, if that's the case, and then there's like, you know, like what, 100 streamers, 200 streamers? Obviously the streamers are a very small, small section of the people that were invited, you know, into the alpha in order to go through and test it. You know, and so it's not that it was only streamers that got invited. You know, how many people play Diablo 2? How many people are excited to play Diablo 2? Millions. Millions. Even at 20,000 people, that is extremely small percent, you know, for millions of people. What was it? Diablo 2 sold, I think it was something around like 15 or 11 million copies. But like, things get wonky with sales reporting back then, and then like digital sales and such. You know, like what, maybe 15 at the high end, maybe 20 million copies of Diablo 2 got sold, and out of all those people, 20,000 people got invites. You know, yeah. You know, you didn't get in. None of your friends got in, because that's just how it is. You know, outside of the people that I know within content creation, none of my friends got in that had signed up, you know, for the alpha and such. And that, I mean, that's just the way that it goes. It's just, you know, be excellent to one another, to quote Bill and Ted. You know, just, you know, yeah. But I get you. It can be frustrating, you know, because you have so much excitement, and here I am hyping the game, you know, for like the first 20 minutes of the episode. That I understand, you know, you're feeling let down by not being able to go through and experience this, you know, and you put 10,000 hours, 20,000 hours into the game. We all did, you know, we're all right there with you, you know, in that. So, you know, just, you know, be respectful is all I can say. You know, obviously, you know, they could always have more. They could always have more people, you know, go through and be in the alpha, and it'd be great to have everybody experience it. You know, hopefully they'll have an open, you know, beta test at some point, as they do with a lot of Blizzard titles, just to get, you know, all hands on deck. But we're giving the game this year. You know, we've waited 21 years, you know, for this without even knowing that we were waiting 21 years for this. And it's not even been 2 months since they announced it. So it's not too much longer that we're going to have to wait in order to get our hands on this game. And there's going to be more testing phases. There'll be more chances at getting in. Like, during the alpha for the single player, they put up opt-in for, like, the multiplayer testing, and now there's, like, a beta opt-in. Not even an alpha, but a beta opt-in as well. So there's going to be some more testing going on. So don't worry. There's more chances. And worst case, hey, yeah, you're going to have the game in your hands no later than 8 months away. You know, we'll all get together, and we'll all go through and kick it on Battle.net with our 8-player games. We can actually have, like, real groups of people going through and playing. So, you know, don't worry. It's coming. And yeah, it's such a good time to be a fan of the Diablo franchise. It's gonna be cool. It's gonna be awesome. We got more D2R testing. We got more Diablo Immortal testing. We got D2R coming this year. We got Immortal coming this year. We've got, like, some surprises in store for Diablo 3. I've talked about this on the last couple of shows, but man, I'm still shocked at the level of infrastructure changes that they put into D3 with the season. That, like, they could do a lot. Diablo 3 has got some legs in it for still. I'm sure. And the granddaddy of them all, Diablo 4. Not this year. You know, I would even caution next year. You know, might not even be a possibility. You know, a lot of that is going to depend. You know, because if it comes around and there's no BlizzCon this year, and they don't do the BlizzCon line, you know, in February, and our next BlizzCon isn't until, you know, November of 2022, then it's like, oh, okay. That's when they're going to announce the class, you know, so we're not gonna get the actual game until after they announce all the classes, right? Yeah. Good stuff. And then also at the same time, you know, for just ARPG fans in general, you know, you had the devs over at Grinding Gear Games going through and talking about Path of Exile 2 with the new trailer. I don't really understand a lot that they were talking about because I don't play Path of Exile, but I can still be excited for my friends that do. And then you've got the Ultimatum patch that's going to be going through, or League. Sorry if I'm not using the proper term. Expansion League, something like that. Interchangeable words. That's going through and dropping this week. It's Friday, right? Because they just released the patch notes for it. So, I mean, there's a lot to go on for being an ARPG fan right now. You're good. Even if you're like, yo, you're done with Diablo 3, your season's already done, you didn't get into the D2 alpha, you got Path of Exile, you know, if you're still looking for that RPG itch. So there's options, there's stuff. We're good. ARPG, as a community, you know, we're good. There's no reason, you know, to even be like, oh, you know, well, I'm a Diablo purist or anything like that. I say this, of course, being the guy that only plays Diablo, and I haven't played PoE, but I don't dislike PoE. It just, you know, it's not the game for me. But that means, it doesn't mean I can't be excited for the people that do. You know? And, you know, as we go through and get close to the end of the episode here, as I've been doing with the last couple of episodes, I want to take a little bit of time to go and talk about some, like, lore and story and things that could potentially impact the next titles that we're going to be going and getting in the Diablo franchise. Pardon me. And this is a question that actually came up during the weekend while I was streaming D2R, that they wanted to know, like, what was the history behind the heroes of the Diablo games. Because we were just playing through Act 2, we had just killed the Summoner in the Arcane Sanctuary, and I just mentioned that, you know, the Summoner is actually the Sorcerer from Diablo 1. And then that kind of, like, led into a conversation about, you know, the heroes of Diablo 1. All of them appear in Diablo 2. It was for a while there, it had already been canon, and later was, like, made hard canon with the Book of Cain, that the Sorcerer kind of, like, lost his mind with the evils and the terrors of the things that he had found going and delving, you know, into the catacombs below Tristram, you know, and the hunt for Diablo. It was one of the things with the Diablo 1, it wasn't necessarily just, you know, hunting to stop the evil. The hero of that story, the warrior, Aiden, the son of King Leoric, obviously, that was his only quest, was to go through, save his brother Albrecht, and kill Diablo. Though maybe in the beginning he didn't fully understand that he was looking to kill Diablo. There was a lot of other adventurers that were being attracted to Tristram because of the stories and the tales of the treasures and the riches that existed in the catacombs below. Part of this was, you know, an evil plot by Lazarus to lure heroes, you know, down into the depths so that way they could be sacrificed and all those other types of things. But, you know, the Sorcerer was one of them, that his mind broke and he was plagued by madness, but he learned secrets down below Tristram about the Arcane Sanctuary. And it was from there that led him over, you know, by the time of Diablo 2, had led him over to Lute Gullane, and he had found the entrance into the Arcane Sanctuary and began to believe that he was in fact that he was in fact Horizon, not Tal Rasha, but that he was in fact Horizon, and that he was trying to be him. You know, Horizon in the lore is one of the most powerful mages to have ever existed, and taking it a step further, you know, into one of the novels, Legacy of Blood, the Arcane Sanctuary itself actually is Horizon, that he was able to transcend his mortal form and merge with the little demi-realm that he had created in the Arcane Sanctuary. And that's, you know, you can always be like, that's why it's so hard to, like, find the actual path to get through the Arcane Sanctuary, is, you know, because Horizon's changing, you know, the structure of the sanctuary around in order to confuse you. Or he grants you mercy and takes you straight to the Summoner that's pretending to be him to rid him of its presence. You know, but it's like the same kind of tragic tale befell the Rogue from Diablo 1, that, you know, she took with her, you know, some, she was changed. Maybe not necessarily corrupted, but she was definitely changed from her experiences down below Tristram. And so it made her easier to be corrupted and tricked by Undariel. And while not necessarily canon, this is something that I've talked about in previous episodes, Phil Schenk on Twitter has been sharing a lot of these early developmental stories. And one of the things that he had written about Bloodraven was that she was in the very early stages of Diablo 2, was that she was the Rogue. You know, that she was the Rogue from Diablo 1, and that she was tricked by Undariel because she had unlocked, like, a strength and potential inside of her down in the catacombs below Tristram, that when she came back, she taught these things to the Rogues, but they were, you know, developing too fast, you know, for it to be checked. And so it became a worry to the Elders, you know, that ruled the Rogue Enclave, and so they kind of had to slow down, but they were easy to be corrupted because Undariel came to, you know, her in a vision and tricked her into actually summoning Undariel into our world and then gifting the Rogues that had been duped by her with the corruption that you know, made them, you know, the corrupted rogues, or like the Blood Raven, which in the D2R is amazing because you can see like the corrupted veins and like the vines or tentacles like wrapping around their bodies and such. It's so disgusting. It's cool. I love it. You know, and so, you know, she gets tricked and corrupted, and her soul gets claimed by the forces of hell because of it. And we all know, of course, the story of the warrior Aiden, who goes on to become the Dark Wanderer, you know, through Diablo 2, and who's the things that he had done have reverberations into Diablo 3. But what about the heroes of Diablo 2? Now, this is the one that we don't have a complete story. Now, originally, early in Diablo 3, they had wanted to say that the barbarian was going to be the same barbarian from D2. But, you know, as a broken man, because the barbarian people are, you know, they're aimless. Their charge for the entire existence of their culture was to protect Mount Ariat, and they failed. Not only did the World Stone become corrupted, but Mount Ariat doesn't exist anymore. Their home is gone. Their reason for being destroyed. And so that he would be this old, you know, gritty, you know, broken veteran that's trying to find like some form of redemption, as being the hero of another story because he failed in the first one. And that's why the barbarian in D3 is, you know, older, gray hair and all of that. But they eventually ended up like dropping that aspect of the story because they didn't want to have to like completely rewrite the dialogue, because like, you know, Cain and the barbarian would know each other. You know, the barbarian would be familiar with certain things. Like, he would, like, Ashara would know him and stuff. And so it would change a lot of stuff. And they opted to just make him a barbarian instead of the barbarian. But then we never actually had a story about what happened to the barbarian, you know, for from Diablo 2. And the few characters that we did get the story of is there's the sorceress, Isandra, who would actually later on become the mentor for Li Ming, the wizard in Diablo 3. So she went back and was going through and serving, you know, for the mage clans in Chaldeum, and was, she was held in very high regard. I mean, she beat, you know, three of the prime evils, you know, the three prime evils, three of the great evils. And so she was held in very high regard, you know, by her colleagues and such. But they also had their eye on her, because the assassin order, you know, is always watching. And the higher ups, the ones that control the mage clans, are always like, well, if you could be a potential danger, we're just going to sick the assassins on you to watch you. Because that says we were introduced to the assassins before Lord of Destruction in base Diablo 2. You could talk to Natalia in Act 3, who is there watching Ormus, because Ormus was supposed to be a super powerful mage, and they just wanted to make sure, well, he's really close to all this corruption going on in Kharost. Let's watch him. Just in case. You never can be too sure. Let's watch him. And so that's kind of a similar incident that happened with the D2 sorceress, is because she had a lot of power, and so they wanted to make sure that they kept tabs on her. But then Chaldeum and the surrounding areas were hit by what was described as like an unnatural heat wave. And people, you know, in the city of Chaldeum, they were able to survive. But out in the deserts and such, the outposts and things, people were dying. Like, I know it's a desert, but it was hotter than it should be. Like, oppressively, like, humanly bakingly hot. And it didn't matter any steps that you took to try and cool down. It was killing people. And, you know, Li Ming was sent out to try and investigate this. And ultimately the mage clans were like, this is kind of beneath us, we need to focus on other things. But the sorceress like took issue with this and went out to go through and try and find a solution. And so she went out to one of the little desert towns and tried to cast a massive spell to like save the people there and reduce the temperature and give them a little bit of peace. But unfortunately it backfired, and instead of just cooling them down, summoned a gigantic blizzard that froze and killed all of the inhabitants of the village that were there. And while she was devastated by this act, the assassin took this as time to do something. And so the one that had been following her took her life. And so she died, you know, while in the middle of grief of having killed a bunch of innocent people. That is the kind of like the sorrow of her legacy. And it's also one of those ones where it's such a Diablo story that you had this great powerful person that just couldn't do enough, you know. And that was the catalyst that caused Li Ming to like leave Chaldeum and go out on her story in order to find Tristram and, you know, fulfill her destiny of being the Nephilim and such. And that's why you see the sorceress, you know, in Pandemonium and during the Reaper of Souls. That's not just a sorceress, that is the sorceress from Diablo 2 that's going through and continuing to try and guide, you know, Li Ming and her near limitless potential being a true Nephilim. The only other person that we really have pure canon knowledge of then is the necromancer, Zul. We see a couple of, you know, Methan, you know, as a student of his, you know, during the events of Diablo 3. And we also get to see and fight alongside Zul going after, you know, another student of his that ends up, you know, forsaking the balance in the order and just tries to go through and fight for power. And so he's got an interesting story, you know, after the events of Diablo 2, reporting back to the Necromancer Order and becoming a teacher to try and develop the next generation of necromancers in order to save the world. Because the necromancers are the true ultimate good guys of the Diablo story. They're some of the few people on the planet that know the truth of the Sin War, know the truth of heaven and hell, how Sanctuary itself was created, that we all came from Nephilim, that we're the children of angels and demons, and that we have to fight for the purity of our realm. Because if the angels try and get too much influence, they could potentially kill us. So the demons want to use us nothing more as a weapon, and the necromancers know it all. And so they're the ultimate good guys because they're always fighting for the side of humanity in order to keep all things balanced in the world of Sanctuary. And so, you know, Zul seeing what's out there and these, you know, fighting against like some of the greatest forces that potentially threatened our world, you know, in lifetimes, is like, well, we need more necromancers. So he goes to try and teach more. Some are successful, like Methan, and other ones, not so much, as we see in Immortal. I think that there's probably going to be more story involving him, because I'm not just, you know, making this up, maybe I am, that the developers have said that we'll see more of Zul and his story and such throughout the events of Immortal, since we didn't get to play the entire game. So there's even more to see there. And that's only like the 5 years after Diablo 2. That obviously then at some point later, you know, he trains Methan, you know, for the events of Diablo 3. And we don't know where he is during the events of Diablo 3, but his story might not have a good ending. Because we do know a couple of things about the ending of Reaper of Souls that we get to see as we're going through Pandemonium and such, that, you know, Malthiel is sending his forces in like the Black Soul Stone and like those kind of like death orbs and such all across Sanctuary, and a full wholesale slaughter, complete genocide, you know, of the human race. And they told us, you know, during BlizzCon line that it's around like 90% of all of humanity was killed during the events of Reaper of Souls. And we also know, playing through the Necromancer storyline, that Malthiel attacked the Necromancers in the Sunken City the hardest out of everything in Sanctuary. Because Malthiel knew the Necromancers were the greatest threat to him. Not just, you know, for their own mastery over death and being able to fight Malthiel, you know, at that same floor, but because they were the ones that they know the truth. You know, a lot of mages might not know. You know, they might be very powerful in their own right, but they don't know the truth behind all of this. They're not as much of a threat as the necromancer that knows exactly what they're dealing with. And the master necromancer goes and gives the character like the speech of like, you're it, you're what's left. Like, we're all dead. Like, all the masters are dead. Yeah, and you have to rebuild the order now. It's in your hands for necromancers to continue. And so that doesn't give a lot of hope. excuse me, doesn't give a lot of hope for the well-being of Zul after the events of Diablo 3. You know, he probably ain't making it to Diablo 4. Let's all be honest with that. And those are the ones that we just have, like, the full canon story for. We don't know what happened to the Paladin. We don't know what happened to the Druid. You know, we don't know what happened to the Assassin. There's some people that want to say that the Assassin that killed Asandra was the Assassin, you know, from Diablo 2, but we don't know. And there are also people that are saying that, like, there is a train of thought that the Assassin, Natalia, was the Assassin that you played through in the events of Diablo 2, and that the story is that, like, you know, as you're going through and hunting down all the evils, the Assassin joins. Because the canon ending of Diablo 2 isn't just one hero, it's all of the heroes. All of the adventurers together have joined forces in order to fight against, you know, Baal, Mephisto, and Diablo during the events of the games. And so one interpretation is that Natalia is the Assassin, and so is the one that joins the forces in Act 3 and then carries on. We don't know what the actual story behind it is. Only Blizzard knows that. So there is the one train of thought that that Natalia is the Assassin that carries with the heroes of Diablo 3 and then later goes on to become like a founding member of the Demon Hunters. You know, after she forsakes the Assassin Order, as we learn from like flavor text on the Natalia set for Demon Hunters. There's also some people that believe that the Assassin from the story, you know, about Li Ming is the one that kills the Diablo 2 sorceress. So there's some, you know, theories out there about what happens. And then there's the Amazon, where we know a little bit, but we don't know if it's canon, because the Amazon actually does have some backstory, but it depends on whether it's real or not. Because it's not from a Diablo game, we learn the Amazon Cassia's story from Heroes of the Storm. And we can at least know from, like, the Necromancer Zul that he was given the name Zul in Heroes of the Storm, but then that later was canonized, you know, by his appearance in Diablo Immortal. So we can assume that Cassia is the name of the Amazon from Diablo 2, but we'll have to wait and see if her backstory in Heroes of the Storm actually is the events that transpired after her appearance in Diablo 2. She was one that took kind of a similar method to, like, Zul of, we're not prepared. You know, even though they went through and they defeated, you know, the three prime evils, but, you know, taking into consideration the destruction of the World Stone, leaving Sanctuary unprepared, she went to hell. She saw what's down there, and that the Amazons need to be better prepared. Skovos is not ready if hell comes and invades Sanctuary tomorrow. So she goes back to the Skovos Isles after the events of Diablo 2 to make the Amazons prepare. She goes on to make sure that we are going to be ready to fight back against hell when it gets here, because it will. And she eventually goes on to transcend to the rank of War Matron, which is like the de facto leader of the Amazon people. So during the events of Diablo 3, it's very well possible that Cassia, the Amazon from D2, is actually the leader of the Amazon people living back down in the Skovos Isles. What happens to Skovos during the events of, you know, Malthiel's genocide? We don't know. And that also kind of goes into, where are these characters by the time that we get to Diablo 4? We don't know. You know, we don't know how long of a time frame is going to happen between Diablo 3 and Diablo 4, and it's something that also is a question that I've, you know, wrestled with a bit, you know, throughout the years on the show, is, you know, the trouble of the Nephilim. You know, you have a hero that's basically a god in Diablo 3 and has defeated the most powerful entities in all of existence multiple times. What can't they do? And so why aren't they the heroes of Diablo 4? Well, you either have to remove them some way, you know, take the Dragon Ball Z, oh, Goku had a heart attack, you know, and that's why the androids took over the Earth. Or Diablo 4 happens, you know, 50 years after the events of Diablo 3 and the Nephilim, you know, with godlike power, but, you know, cursed with a mortal frame, is just now too old to do anything, or even died of old age. You know, and so it's just like the narrative element of how do you get rid of the god, you know, in order to actually tell a story. You know, and so I'm not sure if we'll see any of the Diablo 3 characters into Diablo 4. We also don't even know what is the history, you know, or what is the canon ending for Diablo 3. Because the ending that we saw very explicitly, at least in Reaper of Souls, is that it was one singular Nephilim that beat Malthiel. But, you know, it's an interesting narrative technique that the plural of Nephilim is Nephilim. So you can have the entirety of all the dialogue of Diablo 3 applies both singularly and plural, that they can manipulate the story however they see fit in order to, you know, make the narrative that they want for Diablo 4. Was it a singular Nephilim that went through, fought, and, you know, defeated the prime evil and a souped up, you know, Super Saiyan Malthiel? Or was it an army, you know, a small collection of all of the classes representatively together that fought against, you know, Malthiel, Diablo, and the prime evil during the events of Diablo 3? We don't know. We probably won't know until Diablo 4. Because that was the same thing with Diablo 2. Like, it was a decade before we knew, oh yeah, it was everybody. You know, they kind of just, you know, add that into the story and the setup into the events that happened, you know, for Diablo 3. And when we get closer to the launch of Diablo 4, I'm sure we'll probably see more about that stuff. So, there you go. That's the history of what we know of the characters that existed from, you know, like Diablo 1, Diablo 2, and the question of what will happen to the characters of Diablo 3. There will be more, because Immortal is going to have more. You know, we got to see a little bit of Vala, you know, the demon hunter from Diablo 3. She's an Immortal before she becomes a demon hunter. And then we also saw, you know, Zul and his appearance, you know, 5 years after the events of Diablo 2. There is so much. Immortal is going to be an open world game. It's going to be an MMO. And they're going to continue to expand and build upon the story and mechanics and all other types of stuff as we get to travel throughout the world of Sanctuary. And so I'm sure that we will get to see more. My hope is that we'll get to see it all, and that we'll be able to interact and follow all of the heroes of Diablo 2 eventually to see what became of them, you know, after D2. Are all of them going to have as sad of an ending as Isandra the Sorceress, or potentially Zul, you know, the Necromancer? Don't know. But it would be Diablo, you know, it would be very Diablo-esque for that to happen. You know, Diablo doesn't necessarily really have a happy ending, even when it has a happy ending, right? And with that, it is going to kind of go through and bring us here to a close. I appreciate, you know, everybody that is going through, coming, hanging out here, chatting with me as I record the shows live. And if you're going through and you're listening to this, you know, on YouTube, iTunes, Stitcher, your podcasting platform of choice, if you ever want to go and catch the show live, I record here every other Wednesday night at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific, at twitch.tv/blizzpro. But of course, you can find the podcast anywhere, everywhere. It's uploaded as audio, you know, on the various podcasting platforms, and you can always find the video version of it on YouTube itself, you know, or as the video collection up on the Twitch page. The Twitch page also, you know, we hang out and chat a little bit before the show. We've got the after show afterwards where we talk about anything, everything. So feel free, go ahead, you know, give the stop on by. If you want to go through, know more about the show, when we're going live, if there's ever a delay like there was the one last week, please feel free to go and follow the show over at the WM Workshop on Twitter. You can also follow me personally. I'm pretty active at NineBallGamer on Twitter as well. If you have any thoughts, feedback, if there's a lore question or anything you'd like to discuss on the show, drop me a line, westmarchworkshop@blizzpro.com. Again, that email address is westmarchworkshop@blizzpro.com. And, you know, I hope to see or hear from you soon. And here's hoping we get some even more Diablo news coming up in the next couple of weeks. It's just been so exciting, and I cannot wait to see which of the four games that we have waiting on us now Blizzard's gonna hit us next. So until next time, y'all have a good night.